Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi everybody, my name's Sue Supriano, and the person I'm going to be speaking with today is Mike Gray, who's the author of Drug Crazy, How We Got Into This Mess and How We Can Get Out. And I'm sorry to say it's kind of noisy where we are here at the actually in the press room of the Shadow Convention, and I'm working with the Independent Media Center here during the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles. And I just heard you participate in a panel that was really incredible, talking about the CIA and drugs. And I know, and I haven't even had a chance to look at your book, but I know everyone is raving about it. And I want to urge people to get it because it's really astounding information. So, Mike Gray, I want to welcome you and ask you to tell us about what's in your book and how you came to do this. And
well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, Sue, and I got into this back in 1990 when I first started doing research into the war on drugs. I had done a number of documentary films, and in the past, although lately, of course, I've been involved in Hollywood film production. I wrote the original screenplay for the movie The China Syndrome. But my background really in film began in documentaries, and I decided that one of the things that I probably should do is take a good look at the war on drugs. And I set out to do a documentary. The only problem is I found once I got into it that I didn't know anything about the drug war, that everything that I knew or thought I knew or had been told was totally bogus. So I decided that the most important thing was to get down to naked first principles to find out what really had happened in terms of the history of this event. And the shocking thing to me was that before we began the war on drugs in 1914, we really didn't have a drug war problem in this country. Yeah. Most people are under the impression that the drug war began with Richard Nixon back in the 70s, and the truth is that the drug war actually began around the turn of the century. At that time, we were ramping up toward alcohol prohibition in this country. So you have to understand the mental climate in this nation at that time. People were prepared to pass a constitutional amendment outlawing the sale and manufacture of alcohol. Now think about that. In that kind of a mental framework, a handful of lunatics decided pretty much on their own that they were somehow going to rid planet Earth of the danger of narcotics. And it was a misguided concept, to say the least, because 80 years later, after the expenditure of $1 trillion, and we're now spending $50 billion a year in this country alone, and we've cost countless tens of thousands of lives and broken families. We've got 2 million people in jail, 40% of the people in jail in the United States for drug offenses, nonviolent drug offenses. And that's what we have to show for our 80-year effort. And what about the upside? Well, we've managed to increase the rate of addiction by a factor of 5. In other words, there are 5 times as many addicts per 1,000 in this country as there were when we started on this misadventure back in 1914.
And you hold the drug war responsible for this increase in addiction.
Absolutely. There is nothing else that accounts for it. In other words, prior to the onset of the war on drugs in 1914, drug use was actually in decline. Same thing is true of alcohol prohibition. Before they instituted alcohol prohibition, alcohol use was in disfavor and alcohol use was rapidly declining in this country. If you went to a rich person's house in 1910, they didn't offer you wine with dinner. That was considered déclassé. That was something those poor bohunks in the inner city, those Catholics from Ireland and all that, unsightly crowd of rabble, that whose votes you could buy for a dollar in the saloon, etc., etc. So the concept was, if we could rid ourselves of the scourge of saloons, if we could rid ourselves of the scourge of alcohol, it would be a truly perfect world. Well, the truth is, the people, my grandmother, for example, had that opinion, and she was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she won the war of ideas. She and her sisters in the WCTU actually, think about this, convinced people of the United States that drinking was so bad that they were willing to pass a constitutional amendment against it. Now, that's success in public relations. Unfortunately, just when they were winning the war of public opinion about the evil of alcohol, they decided to call in the cops and make it official. And that instantly reversed everything. All of a sudden, the consumption of hard liquor skyrocketed because beer is bulky, and you only have to have a brewery to make beer. And at that time, it had to have refrigerators and refrigerator cars and tankers and so forth. None of that was available, so they had to... people, you've seen this phenomenon. College football games on Saturday afternoon. College students primarily are beer drinkers. Basically, their drug of choice is beer when they first get there. But you can't drink beer in the stadium, so they take a hip flask. And thus, they become hard liquor drinkers in the prohibited atmosphere of the football stadium. So that's basically what we have with the war on drugs. We've created a cachet where it's exotic and interesting and attractive and glamorous. And if you're in the inner city, the guy who has the most dough, the guy who has the best ride, the guy who has the girls and the guns is the drug dealer. So that's become the role model that we've created, and we've done this through our drug laws. We have created this mythical character of the hero of the inner city, and at the same time destroyed the inner city economically by creating this incredible crime wave. Because here's the thing. People associate drugs and crime. Drugs are not associated with crime. The drug war is what is causing crime. It's not the drugs. People who take heroin generally go to sleep. People who smoke marijuana sit down, and probably the worst thing that they're going to attack is a bag of potato chips. The one drug, incidentally, there is one drug that has been invariably associated with violence, and that is alcohol. So
I think something like 80% of all the murders and the violence involve not only guns but alcohol.
That's very true. And it's interesting that when you dig into the statistics for so-called drug violence, and this was one of the things that shocked me, because I tracked this down to bedrock. And the one thing about my book, Drug Crazy, How We Got Into This Mess and How We Can Get Out, every paragraph in that book is locked down to bedrock. You will find it thoroughly footnoted, and even though it's an easy read, and it may be written like a novel, and it's a fairly dramatic story that begins with a shootout on the south side of Chicago with some of my undercover friends waiting for a drug dealer, and progresses up through the whole history of the drug war. But the one thing that is really clear is that the violence is generated by prohibition, and that the drugs themselves have actually nothing to do with it.
Yeah, they probably make people, like you say, real relaxed, not real aggressive.
Well, that's very true. Consistently, when you check into drug statistics and you see that there is some association between drugs and violence, you find, if you check into the details, that the person was on alcohol at the time. In other words, he may have been smoking marijuana, but he was also drunk. And that's always the case. In other words, they did, for example, a survey here in California. The Department of Transportation in California checked out the difference between marijuana smokers and alcohol alcohol drinkers and found out that marijuana smokers actually were better drivers in some cases than people who were straight. I'm not recommending this, but I'm just stating it as a fact. Alcohol drivers became aggressive and hostile. And marijuana smokers slowed down because they knew that they were impaired, and they tended to simply drive more safely as a result. So this idea that drugs leads to violence is cuckoo, and it's certainly not proven by the facts. There, I challenge anyone. Incidentally, I must say one thing, Susan, here. I have offered to debate General McCaffrey, his side boy, Bob Wiener, and everybody involved on the government side of this issue. They will not debate me anywhere, anytime. The Drug Policy Forum of Texas has offered a $1,000 reward for anyone who can find anyone who will debate me, any government official who will in open debate. Now, I did have a debate on this issue. The Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii asked me to come out there, and apparently the district attorney in Hawaii had not heard of my book, and he certainly hadn't read it, because he opened himself up, and I ran over him like a steamroller. Every fact out of his mouth, I not only challenged but proved beyond the record from the federal government's own numbers, from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, from the Drug Enforcement Administration, and so forth, that everything he had said on this issue was totally false.
Well, that's pretty astounding, not to me, because I've been following this for a while, although I certainly don't know as much as you do, Mike Gray. But and of course, the voters of California, and I don't know what other states, have voted for the legalization of medical marijuana, at least, and the federal government continues to ignore the wishes of the people in many ways, and certainly in that one. But that's just about marijuana. But I know that this is a story of politics, as so much of life. How all this got so turned around. How, and then that people have these ideas about drugs, and maybe we should define drugs. I guess drugs are what are on the books called drugs.
Well, there are 100,000 people in this country who are going to die this year, Sue, from legal prescription drugs. Now think about that. 100,000 people are going to die as a result of legally prescribed drugs that they bought at the pharmacy under doctor's orders. Okay, now how many people are going to die from cocaine and heroin this year? 5,000. How many people are going to die from marijuana this year? None. Zero. 100,000 people will die this year from smoking tobacco. 400,000 people will die this year. I'm sorry, I've got that backwards. 400,000 people will die from alcohol. And 100,000 people will die from smoking cigarettes. And not a single person will die as a direct result of smoking marijuana. It is the most benign drug. Now, why is it?
Helpful.
Well, actually, it is for many people. This has been well known. It's established in the medical records going back 3,000 years. It is an analgesic. We now know that it controls muscle spasms of people who have diseases like MS and so forth. It's tremendously beneficial for people with brain injuries and so forth. And of course, it's been well documented as a nausea suppressant. It's instant as a nausea suppressant. People say, well, you've got Marinol. You can take Marinol. This is clearly someone who's never had the dry heaves in college. I mean, you know, if you've ever been in a situation of having severe nausea, that the last thing you want to do is take a pill and try to keep it down for half an hour before it takes effect. Whereas I have seen this happen. People with severe nausea smoke a marijuana joint, and I mean within seconds, that nausea is suppressed. What more effective medicine could you ask for someone who is undergoing chemotherapy? And so this is... It is a medicine that has legitimate uses. So why is the federal government after us now? Even though here in California we voted as the voter initiative passed by 56% of the vote that the people of California wanted sick people to have access to medical marijuana. The federal government came in and threatened to arrest any doctor who even associated with this idea. Now, why is this? What's behind this energy? It's very simple. Dan Baum wrote a book, which I read when I was doing the research for my book called Smoke and Mirrors. And Baum follows the drug war from the Nixon era. But he makes it quite clear, and I think makes a very compelling case, that marijuana use is essential to the government as a component of the drug war for these reasons. If you include marijuana, the government says we've got 13 million serious drug users in the country. But let's say that you take marijuana out of the equation, then you're left with only 3 million so-called serious drug users. How do you justify a $50 billion a year jihad to get 3 million people, less than 1.5 tenths of 1,000 people to sit down and take their seats? I mean, if you're only talking about 3 million people, a tiny, tiny percentage of the population. So clearly, in order to maintain the drug war, the federal government must insist that marijuana be a part of this equation. And that's why they are attacking medical marijuana everywhere it crops up, because they know that they have been successful by intimidating people and getting parents into thinking that marijuana is worse than heroin or as bad as heroin and so forth.
It leads to heroin if it... Also.
Absolutely, that it leads to heroin. And... if you are successful in cutting that tie, then the whole drug war starts to unravel. Because the American people, once they realize that marijuana is not the devil weed, but is in fact a medical component that existed in the U.S. pharmacopoeia and was freely prescribed by doctors up until 1937, when they begin to understand that, then it makes it much more difficult for the government to argue the case that this devil weed needs, that anybody who touches it needs to be thrown in jail. So,
but then who would you put in prison?
Well, that would certainly, I mean, if they legalize marijuana, the prison industrial complex collapses, and Wackenhut Security and the Corrections Corporations of America, their stock would drop like a loose cage in a mine shaft if marijuana were legalized tomorrow morning. They're aware of this, and that's probably one reason why the Prison Guards Union in the state of California, one of the most potent political forces in this state, one organization that has been responsible, directly responsible for electing the last two governors of California, both Pete Wilson, Republican, and Gray Davis, a Democrat, elected because the Prison Guards Union gave the largest single contribution of any group in the state. Now, why? Well, they're just union guys who are looking for full employment. How do you maintain full employment? Well, you keep passing draconian drug laws with mandatory minimum sentences. So if medical marijuana is acceptable, then their whole argument begins to collapse right around them, and they lose employees, membership, income, dues, the works. So they're going to fight this hammer and tong. It is a losing battle for them, however, because the truth is coming out.
And what about the other substances? When you say that alcohol and legal drugs kill many, many, many more people than, well, you didn't say than illegal drugs, you just said than marijuana, I think. I'm not sure what you said,
well,
Mike Gray, author of Drug Crazy, just to re-identify you.
Yeah, I think that the total number of drug deaths from all illegal drugs this year will be less than 5,000. Okay, that includes cocaine, crack, marijuana. Marijuana, as I said, has not ever killed anyone in the entire 3,000-year recorded history of the drug. There is not a single case they can cite that actually where someone died as a result of ingestion of marijuana. But these other drugs, cocaine, heroin, and so forth, now all of those deaths, incidentally, are completely unnecessary. Those deaths are not, could not, should not be laid at drugs per se, but at the drug war. Because, for example, I did an article for Rolling Stone called Texas Heroin Massacre that ran last year in the May issue of Rolling Stone about Plano, Texas, a very wealthy suburb north side of Dallas, where they had 18 kids. These are rich kids who drive their own SUVs and had good grades in school and went to, I mean, this is a high school. Plano High School has got more money than you know what to do with. This is a corporate nesting ground for the fabulously wealthy. As somebody once characterized Plano as tract mansions. And these kids were told by the authorities that heroin and marijuana were equivalent, that marijuana was just as bad as heroin. Well, the kids went out and they smoked marijuana and nothing happened. They got giggles and they ate all the cookies in the house. But basically, nothing serious happened. So they figured, aha, the adults are lying to us about drugs. They assumed that since we were lying about marijuana, that we were also lying about heroin. Well, guess what? We weren't lying about heroin, it turns out, but how were they supposed to know? Are they supposed to guess that, hey, now we're telling you the truth, now we're trying to scare the pants off of you and now we're lying through our teeth. And, you know, we can't, I mean, once you lose credibility with your children, you've lost it. It's almost impossible to recover and convince them that now you're telling the truth.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that because of all the things that you're saying, Mike Ray, that people have lost credibility with a lot of children because a lot of it, as you're pointing out, is not true.
Well, these kids told me, I mean, they were laughing at these federal government ads that Barry McCaffrey is creating, you know? I mean, they were laughing at this is your brain on drugs, you know, with a skillet and that gorgeous little girl in the tank top tearing up her kitchen, you know, and saying this is heroin and this is your brain on heroin. The kids respond to that and say, you know, like, I think I'll go out and fry some eggs. They think it's a joke because they know that what we're telling them is not true. Now, in Holland, as I tried to tell General McCaffrey on CNN, if the Dutch don't do it that way, they give their kids medical information. They don't give them symbolism and skillets and eggs and that sort of thing. They tell them medical information about these drugs, what they will do, good and bad. They don't pull any punches. As a consequence, and they rely on their kids to use common sense and good judgment in order to steer clear of danger. And by relying on their kids to use their own good judgment and giving them the facts, they have a lower addiction rate in this country across the board, all ages, all drugs. According to the latest numbers, and I went to Holland while I was doing research for the book Drug Crazy, and I spoke with Bernard Scholten, who is the chief police spokesman for the city of Amsterdam, and he said marijuana is not a problem for us. Our problem is alcohol. Here are the figures. Look at them. And he said, we have a very good policy. He said, my job is primarily spending most of my time talking to U.S. officials who come over here full of lies and mistaken impressions, and I have to take them around by the hand and explain to them the truth, that our policies are working and have been tremendously effective, and that Dutch drug use across the board, all ages, teenagers, adults, everything, they have 40% less marijuana use than we do in this country, and they can go down to the corner and buy it any hour of the day or night. Now, I walked up to a cop on the street in Amsterdam, and I said, can you direct me to a marijuana coffee shop? He says, you go down to the end of this block, you see a store with a plant in the window, that's it. I went in there, and I found a group of businessmen sitting at the bar having a joint, and some Germans over at a table playing chess and smoking hashish, and some stunned tourists from Ohio with their mouths open, trying to figure out what was going on here. And across the street were a bunch of college students falling out of a saloon, drunk out of their minds, being rowdy and turning over furniture. So, you know, I mean, the contrast was really significant. And the Dutch government has understood this all along. And that's why the chief spokesman for the Dutch police department in Amsterdam said, our problem is not marijuana, it's alcohol. Now, they have a similar tolerant attitude toward hard drugs. They do not crack down on hard drug users. All of this stuff is still illegal, incidentally, in Holland, because they have signed the international conventions. They were forced to by the United States. The United States has forced every other country in the, almost every other country on the planet, to follow our example, and we've got the muscle to back it up. So over their objections, they went along with us in the United Nations, and they've had to maintain this posture of that this stuff is technically illegal, but how do they deal with the reality? And how they do it, in Holland they have what is known as the principle of expediency, which is kind of a cute little way of saying that if they've got a law on the books that they find is causing more trouble than it's worth, they don't bother to go through all the problems of trying to withdraw the law or overturn it. They just simply stop enforcing it. And that's basically what they did with marijuana and with hard drugs. They just simply said, you know, we're going to handle this system sensibly, regardless of what the law says, and we'll work our way around it.
So rational.
Quite rational. Well, as I said in the book, the Dutch have had experience with rationality because their enemy is the North Sea. And when I went to the city hall in Amsterdam, it's very interesting because there is a huge glass column in the center of the atrium. And there's you look up over, and it's full of water. And the water is like, you know, 20 feet over your head there as you're standing in the lobby. And that water column is connected to the North Sea at Ismuden. And it shows exactly where the water level would be if the dike broke. So when your enemy is the North Sea, it breeds a certain sense of practicality, you know? The Dutch are not interested in what religiously would be desirable as far as the dikes are concerned. They are simply interested in how tall they should be, how well built they should be, and to make sure that they work. They're basically engineers, and they've approached this drug problem in exactly the same way. And I guess that's why I have tremendous admiration for not only their results, but also for their approach, because I am, in fact, an engineer myself, and that's kind of how I got into this whole business of journalism, because my approach is to examine the problems that are the most serious problems that we're facing, and to, as an engineer, disassemble these problems and see if a solution can be reassembled from the pieces.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, Mike Ray, and I wonder, you know, since it is so very political in the media, and we haven't even talked about all these things, and I know that I'm sure you must address it all in the book, because it's your book, Drug Crazy, How We Got Into This Mess and How We Can Get Out. So people, if they want to know more, should get that. It's published by Random House, the hardback, and the new paperback version is published by Routledge,
right, yes, yeah. In New York. Yeah, and you can get it through Amazon.com or any of the electronic media. You can also find it in most of the major bookstores, although from Amazon you can get the paperback edition discounted, I think, for $11 right now.
Mm-hmm. So, well, in the last couple of minutes, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think here at the... during the Democratic National Convention, at the Shadow Convention today, they're talking actually about drugs. People are talking about things that are not talked about at the Democratic National Convention at all, as I understand, whatsoever. Do you think anything's going to change? Do you feel any trend happening? You say that no one will even debate you from the government.
Yes, there is a tremendous sea change. One of the major movers and shakers here is Arianna Huffington, who has convened this shadow convention along with Ethan Nadelman of the Lindesmith Center. And this represents a real major sea change in the drug war here. And the drug czar in Washington is quite aware of this. And if there was any way they could prevent us from holding this meeting here at Patriotic Hall, just six blocks south of the Democratic Convention, I'm sure they would do it.
They were trying with the bomb scare yesterday, but it didn't work.
That's right. I understand they had a bomb scare after I left yesterday. Tried to chase everybody out of the place and couldn't do it. So, but I mean, seriously, if there was any way they could stop us, but it's unstoppable. We now have police officers, politicians, judges, federal judges, Joe McNamara, former chief of police of San Jose, a leading fighter against the drug war in this movement, and more and more politicians coming out every day. Governor Gary Johnson of New Mexico just spoke here. He's the principal elected sitting governor now, but he tells us, and this is interesting, because I spoke to Gary Johnson privately about this 3 weeks ago, and he said that when he gets together with other governors, they all sort of sidle up next to him and say, right on. You know, they say, I don't dare come out and say this in public, but I think what you're doing is wonderful. And he is determined to end the drug war, and so am I.
Well, thank you so very much, Mike Ray, author of Drug Crazy, and my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.